at one point, I didn't know if they were actually simulating or if they were doing what Nymphomaniac Volume 1
Oh,
does.
yeah.
But I think they were whole hogging it.
Yeah, they were.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
Everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined as always by the voice of CinemaSins, Jeremy Scott.
Hi, ho.
Yeah, and from Music Video Sins, Barrett Scher.
Hello from a bunker.
Yeah. And we are doing our first remote podcast in a long time because of, you know, the bullshit going on out there. COVID-19. We did podcasts on this service called Zencaster a long time ago, and it was very good for our needs. And we're gonna do it again for as long as this has to happen, right? I mean, like, scary stuff hearing of like, you know, hey, let's open up everything after 2 weeks.
Yeah,
I'm like, not happy about that at all.
And, I'm not. And you look at China, not that this is a COVID podcast, although I think every podcast is probably a COVID podcast at this point. But China's reopening Wuhan, like the place where it all started, because they have it locked down enough there. And, you know, I will shelter in place as long as I have to and as long as I'm able.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have the luxury of doing that. And actually, certainly with the YouTube stuff, but also I do want to shout out this company, Zencaster. We've worked with since they were getting started, and they've actually put their plan of multiple hosts, which usually costs, I think, $20 a month or so, is free for this time.
Oh, wow.
That's the kind of good-hearted people that work for this place. So we really appreciate it. We're going to sound a little bit different, but hope you guys don't mind.
Yep. Today we're going to be getting back into our March Madness for the best of the decade. And we're going to go back into the North region after so long. It's been like 6-7 weeks since we've actually been in the North region.
It's been long enough that they've had time to cancel the actual March Madness tournament.
That is very true. Like, at first they were going to just do it with no people, and I was like, what does that do?
Like,
I'm like, oh, we'll let the press be in there, but okay, still, I don't get it. If we're trying to stop the spread, I don't get it. But yes, we're going to go back to the North region. This is officially movies we've actually discussed now, and they're going to be going up against each other. Let's start off with two movies I've seen in the past 24 hours.
Wow.
Oh, geez.
Phantom Thread and Ooh. Hell or High Water.
Ooh.
Phantom Thread is the 7 seed. Hell or High Water is the 2 seed. And I definitely needed to watch these movies again. It had been a while since I had seen Hell or High Water. It definitely, since the movie came out, Phantom Thread, even though I had seen it twice, I needed to see it one more time. To really give this one a fair shake. Hell or High Water and Phantom Thread are both as good as I remember. And I actually might have even made it harder.
Well, I love Phantom Thread is an interesting movie for me because I don't really like it very much, but I've watched it like 5 times because it's so clearly art to me.
Right.
And there are so many things about it to admire. And even the last time I saw you guys, when we had brunch together, I was putting the little sausages onto my plate. And I said, and some sausages, just because I love that scene when she's waiting on him and he's ordering like everything on the goddamn menu.
Yeah.
And she's writing it all down. And then he goes, and some sausages. And she has this flirty little, and some sausages. Like, you can tell she likes
him. Yeah.
It's such a pure moment. There's so much to like about this movie. And, you know, I'm mostly joking when I say I don't like it. I don't like him.
Yeah.
And,
as a character, you know, obviously.
Yeah, and I don't really like the resolution, but it's a masterwork. I don't think I can deny that.
Yeah, it's a tough one to get around, right? Like, I agree with you. But I keep thinking of just new reasons why Alma does all the things that she does in this movie. This recent time, like, at first I was like, okay, this is just her way of, like, getting in touch with him. This is the only way the relationship works, is if she poisons him, which is fucked up. This most recent watching of it, I was like, it could also have she could also be in a weird way caring for him, because he thinks about these dresses way too much, obsessively thinks about his day and trying to get this day perfect. Everything is just about, let's do this dress. Everything is about the dress. Let's make this month's dress. Once that month's dress is done, it's time for the next dress. And the only way that he stops that is if she poisons him and he doesn't think about it. And he realizes that the dress can still get done without him.
That's an interesting, what was the sequence of events is she's trying to hurt him. Right. And then it becomes the fact that she enjoys caring for him.
Yes.
And that. Right. But initially she's trying to injure him. Correct.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. She reads about the just enough, like she reads on that little pamphlet about the mushroom she's picking. I think it just shows you're like how much you can give someone without them dying. Right. He's turned into exactly what we saw early in the movie with the last girlfriend. And we know that there are plenty of other girlfriends before that, because he says something like, I thought we talked about this. And she goes, well, we didn't, but you may have said, you may have been confusing me for somebody else.
Yeah.
I think he's become that point, but she's the one that has sort of figured out like, look, we have something here, and I'm gonna do something extremely fucked up and unlawful to keep us together somehow, some way.
Yeah, and it works. You see that ahead of time, right? When that scene where she gets all mad at the lady who's fall over drunk wearing the dress, and so she grabs him and storms to the hotel room or whatever and demands the dress back. And that's a moment where you can tell this has never happened. None of his previous girlfriends have ever done this.
Yeah. I love that scene so much.
Yeah. It's great.
Everything leading up to it, because at first it starts at breakfast and his sister, Cyril is like, this woman may ask you to go to the wedding or whatever. And he's like, do I have to hear about this now? Couldn't I have heard about that later? And she goes, this woman is paying for this house essentially. So you should do whatever she wants you to do. And she comes in and she's very, she's concerned about the way she looks. She doesn't want to pull off her earrings. She doesn't want to do anything that makes her look uglier, quote unquote. She doesn't think any dress is going to make her look good. But she's very like demanding of him. They go to this reception and she's like falling over drunk in this dress, which is an extreme insult. You know, their family takes her home and she's sleeping in that dress and they're like, when it finally gets up to Alma going in there and taking that dress off and everything, she goes, whatever Mrs. Rose does in her personal life is her own business, but she will never act this way in a dress made from House of Woodcock, you know.
Oh my God, she's terrifying. She's got such a backbone. You see it from the very beginning, because she is timid a little bit when she's being observed, obviously, when she's being measured and everything. But once she shows her backbone, she can take care of herself. Mm-hmm. And she's going to stand up for herself, even when she goes to that fucking New Year's party on her own. Like, she's just willful. And for a reason, you know, she does have a backbone. She's not going to take his bullshit.
Yeah.
I love that scene too. The first date that they have, he's showing her around the town, all that typical date stuff. They have a conversation. And then even when he's like, would you do something for me? It seems like, oh, just part of the date, you know?
Yeah.
And he wants to fit her for this dress. And it's like this, it gets like extremely too personal right off the bat. And then it becomes too mechanical. And then the sister walks in. And that's even, and that makes, she now realizes this is, the date's no longer happening. The date is, you know, she's writing down measurements and all that. And there's a point where he just very simply says, you have no breasts. And doesn't say that as an insult, but just says it matter of fact. And it's like almost, it's almost worse because he says it's so matter of fact.
Yeah.
But I love this movie. I loved it the first couple of times I watched it, but it's been a while since I'd seen it. So
it's amazing to me that besides Daniel Day-Lewis, there's really no huge famous people in this movie.
No.
You know what I mean?
No, there's not.
You know, it's Paul Thomas Anderson, obviously, and it's Johnny Greenwood doing the score. But besides maybe Leslie Manville, like, there's not somebody that you could really point to and say, like, oh, yeah, that person's in that movie.
Right. It goes up against Hell or High Water, and I was glad I watched this again, too, because this movie's fucking awesome. I'm trying to think if I pulled anything else out of this that I didn't before, but I just love this. I love the story and I love the performances. I think Ben Foster seems better to me in this role than he did the first time I watched it. There's something about, and he didn't, I don't think he didn't get nominated for this, but it's one of those performances that you feels like you really, he really should have when you're through it. Just feels like he should have been nominated.
Yeah, and Chris Pine, God, everybody, it's really those two and Jeff Bridges that really anchor this movie. But Chris Pine, I can't stop loving him. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't. He's awesome in everything I see him in.
Mm-hmm.
And he just elevates. He's just got such a casual charm that doesn't feel forced. And the way they play off of each other, they don't look anything like brothers, but you buy that they're brothers completely because of how they act against each other. And I love how Ben Foster is all like, he's criticizing, even though he's been in fucking jail, he's like, well, you know, we could have fed them skinny cows. And, you know, what, he's like criticizing everything that's gone wrong while he's been gone, but there's still love in his voice. He's sad his mom is, you know, dead and he wasn't able to help. God, this movie wrecks me every single time.
Yeah.
Is this movie long?
No.
I don't think so.
It's an hour and 45 minutes, I think, with credits.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like it goes along real quickly. And it's paced really, really well. The director, Tyler Hackford, or is it?
It's Grant McKenzie.
Grant McKenzie. Is he the one that also did Wind River?
No, that was Taylor Sheridan who wrote this.
Taylor Sheridan. Okay, I got you.
Yeah. And I get it confused a lot, too, because Taylor Sheridan is like the more famous person in that grouping. Right. It's David McKenzie. I said Grant McKenzie, but it's David McKenzie. Gotcha. But David McKenzie has done a couple of movies that I've heard of, but I don't think I've seen them. He did Outlaw King, which was a Netflix movie that Chris Pine was in. And he did a movie called, I think I'd heard of this Young Adam movie. It's got Ewan McGregor and Tilda Swinton, but, he hasn't done very many other things that you've probably heard of. But Taylor Sheridan for sure has done a lot of stuff that you've heard of, at least written or directed. So,
yeah. Didn't he write Sicario?
He did. He did. Yeah. Hell or High Water is great. Jeff Bridges was better for me the second time around on this too. There's a scene, it's not, you ever watch a movie sometimes and you see a scene that there's not much going on, but an actor's performance seems way better for some reason, just the little things. I always think about, and this is getting off track a little bit, but I think of Sean Penn in the movie Milk, when he's going through the hallway and he's talking to all of his staff and everything, and he does all these little, he's saying hi to everybody in this hallway, and he makes he does all these little motions and stuff like that that are easily just forgotten because they're so natural and everything. They don't seem like a performance at all. Jeff Bridges, when he's going to talk to the bank, the first couple of banks that have been knocked over and everything, he just has this way about him. They're like, somebody mentions, yeah, it's probably tweakers, and he's like, it's not tweakers. Tweakers don't knock over banks, they knock over gas stations and stuff like that, and it's not tweakers. And then so, like, you know, he goes in and the little different things, like he needs to get information out of this person, so he talks to that person a different way. And he has these little knowledge things that, because he's definitely experienced and everything, he comes up with these little things like, oh yeah, that's probably this and that, I've seen this before. You know, he even knows like he even seems to know what the game is. Like, well, they're stealing only the 5s, 10s, and 20s. So they're obviously just trying to get to a certain amount. They're trying to collect a certain amount instead of just trying to get rich. And and just little things, the way he pulls that whole scene off, I think that's like a masterclass in acting that you don't see those very often in like Oscar reels and stuff, because they're not the showy things. But man, he's so good in that. I can't even really explain what he does in that scene, but he's great.
Yeah, he and his partner, like, he needles his partner the whole fucking movie.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes with racist jokes, sometimes with just, hey, answer the phone, it's your phone, while I'm driving. and then later on, when they're talking about the banks and his partner keeps interrupting him and he's got the map out on the truck and he gets so exasperated with him and it's just like, let me finish.
Yeah.
In the hotel room, he's making fun of the football he's watching and the religion. And,
yeah.
But at the end, when his partner gets shot, there's that whine of sincere pain where he's like, and you know, he has to go right back into police mode. But it wrecks me, man, because it's so real.
And this is right after, but his partner gets shot, and he's been constant with these jokes the whole time. And Ben Foster's up there, like, shooting from like 300 yards away, shooting at all the cops, and of course the Texas locals who want to like be a hero that day.
Right.
But he's like going there, he's like sitting there like while this is going on, he goes, why don't you go up there and like just use one of your tomahawks and knock him down? And that's as soon as he says that, the guy gets shot.
Yeah.
And he knows immediately that, or, you know, exactly, he needs to get back into this other mode, you know. And yeah, he's so good in that, and I believe he did get nominated for this. Bridges did. So yeah, this movie is great, and it goes up against Phantom Thread. And how are we going to vote on this, guys?
Hell or high water.
Hell or high water. Jeremy goes.
It was easy for me, by the way.
Yeah,
it is, man. I love me some hell or high water. It's become evident, especially as we're doing this, this bracket, that there are some directors that are just for me. Noah Baumbach is, Paul Thomas Anderson is, Stanley Kubrick obviously was. I'll eat up anything that they will give me. And I think Phantom Thread, while not raising to the level of, to me, The Master, or to Boogie Nights or things like that, I think it is technically such an achievement, and that those two leads work off of each other so perfectly that I'm gonna vote for that. You could say the same about both sets of leads in Hell or High Water too. Their interactions are what makes the movie, basically. But I think we've never seen anything put together so marvelously as Phantom Thread. So I'm gonna vote for that one.
Yeah. So Phantom Thread, I think, is definitely a better technically made movie. It's got a lot of things that you can go deep and philosophical about. I think one movie does certain things like certain areas of filmmaking are way better in Phantom Thread, but some are areas in Hell or High Water are way better than that movie than in Phantom Thread. So like Hell or High Water's got the plot. It's got a plot advantage. It's got a sort of an ingenuity advantage. Phantom Thread's got a, you know, cinematography and shot composition. Although Hell or High Water's got some great cinematography in it too. But I'm going Hell or High Water here.
Oh, God.
I would have thrown a tantrum if, I mean, not that you would be wrong. You're all entitled to make your choices, but I really didn't want Hell or High Water to go out this early.
All right, everybody. It is time to talk about Mubi once again.
Mubi!
And there are a lot of interesting movies on there right now. I watched a movie called Workers, is about a man who is it's about two people. A man who is a janitor at a Phillips bulb factory, and his ex-wife, who is a servant or of some sort to this rich woman in Tijuana. And they're divorced, but we don't really get much we know that they've had a child that's died, and that sort of broke them up in the past. There's not really any connection. They just the movie just goes from him and to her throughout. Like, it just switches back and forth. And it's really interesting. I mean, the guy who's playing this janitor is, you just don't know what's going on and behind in his head at all. He's just a blank slate for the most part. You don't know. Sometimes people ask him a question and you wonder if he's even going to answer. And he does eventually, but he does a lot of surprising things in this, despite being this reserved person. And you're just like, what is going on with this guy? And his story brings one of the biggest surprises in the movie, something that you will never guess is going to happen. And then his ex-wife is working for this rich woman who is dying. And really the big thing that this rich woman is worried about is her dog named Princess. After she dies, what's going to happen to the dog? And so this dog is pampered more than most humans are. The dog has, like, you know, you see them measure out a perfect amount of like steak for this dog.
just like Jeremy's cats.
Yeah, exactly. there's music that's playing that somebody doesn't like, they're like, you know that this dog doesn't like that music, so they have to turn it down and all that type of thing. And so it's one of those things, by the way, that you'll want to, I don't even know if this movie is popular enough or known enough to look it up on doesthedogdie.com.
Oh, wow.
But I'm going to go ahead and give you that spoiler. the servants of the house, after this woman dies, leaves her will saying, I'm going to keep paying all you guys in the afterlife, essentially, to take care of my dog, and that dog has to die of natural causes before you leave. So that's their job to do that. And can they do it is the question.
Wow.
And so these two stories are going back and forth like this. They're not connected whatsoever, other than the fact that these two used to be married. And it's really, really well shot, well done. It's from Mexico, I think. It's at least shot in Mexico, and there's an opening shot of a beach where you see the wall that's between the United States and Mexico. This is back in 2013. There's a wall like that goes like sort of extends into the ocean. So you see people talking through these little bars to each other and stuff like that. I'd never thought of the wall that way, going into the ocean. But this movie's very interesting. It's on Mubi right now, and it's really good.
Wow.
There's a lot of interesting movies on there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you what, so Mubi is this curated streaming service where you wouldn't ever – have access to something like workers, things from other countries, from lesser known filmmakers and things like that. And it's fantastic, and it'll surprise you every time. A couple of weeks ago, Chris and I caught Toxic Avenger was on there at the beginning. We were like, what the hell? Okay, let's do
it. Yeah, let's do it.
They do a really good job of grabbing you with thumbnails. And in particular, I got grabbed by a thumbnail on this one. It's called the Daughters of Fire.
Yeah.
And nudity! It will grab you. There's a lot of nudity on there. It's a bunch of women hanging out fairly naked. And so, sure, I'll check that out. It's an Argentine film. It's fascinating in what doesn't happen. It's the story of two casually connected lovers, women. One is a long distance swimmer, and one is a director. And so, the long distance swimmer comes back from a long trip. And she says, well, what are you going to do? What's your next project going to be? And she says, I'm going to make a porno. And so the rest of the narrative is them shooting this porno, using people that they know, using people that they pick up during the trip, using actors and things like that. And, man, one of the descriptions says that it subverts the male gaze. And it certainly does do that. Having said that, there's a lot of whacking off in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
there's one, I mean, just absolute, like, full-on get it.
Yeah.
Get it twice, actually.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so, I mean, it's very, very interesting. It's very empowering. It's very feminist. I enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed it in a different way than a feminist looking at it would enjoy it. But I did enjoy those aspects.
So I think everybody knows what happened after you were done with the movie. Oh, why did I say that?
Yeah.
Why did I say that?
It's funny. I thought about this during the movie. I was like, is this titillating in any way? She's making a porno, and she's making it like a feminist porno. And it appealed to me intellectually. It did not appeal to me sexually. It was just interesting to see.
Well, I guess one thing that you can say about the way the sex is framed and shot and presented is that you get the sense that it's about their pleasure and not anybody watching's pleasure.
Correct.
So that's where it comes from. Like, at first I was like, when I started watching this, I was like, yeah, but aren't you still just showing nudity and sex and everything? Isn't that just, you know, what are you really doing here? But then as the scenes go on, you're like, wait a minute, this is actually not anything that I need to just sit here and, like, you know, worry about my own self during it and everything.
Yeah. And these are long, uninterrupted takes. At one point, I didn't know if they were actually simulating or if they were doing what Nymphomaniac Volume 1 does.
Oh yeah.
But I think they were whole hogging it.
Yeah, they were.
It's fascinating. Very much worth a watch. There's a ton of stuff on Mubi right now, including those two. You can be fascinated, you can be titillated. Go to Mubi.com/CinemaSins and you get 30 days of this stuff, man. You will find something to watch that will blow your mind. 30 days, man. It's good stuff.
That's up to 60 films. That's up to 60 films. You can whole hog it for 30 days while you're self-isolating.
That's true. This is a perfect time to do
it. Yes, indeed. Hell or High Water will advance. It will go up against the winner of La La Land versus Roma.
Oh my God.
La La Land is the 6 seed. Roma is the 3 seed. Okay, so Roma is the movie that I've seen most recently, although now it's been like 2 months since I've seen it. And La La Land I haven't seen in a while. How do we tackle these two movies?
I'll tell you how we tackle these. Jeremy and I have to arm wrestle.
Oh, boy.
Virtual arm wrestle, because we are on the diametrically opposed in this battle in particular. I've gone back to Roma. There's a lot to love about Roma, but I can't love it with my whole heart like I do La La Land.
Oh man. See, I am going to have to accept the fact that Roma is not going to win this bracket because Barrett is wrong and stupid. And
I'm stupid. I'm not wrong.
For me, okay, so I love La La Land. When I first saw it in theaters, I was mesmerized. It gave me that old-time Gene Kelly musical feeling a couple of different times, and that I was raised on that shit. It's waned a little, and by that I mean it's gone from like an A-plus to like an A or an A-minus. It's still great, and I love it. It just ultimately, God, I hate this. This is where I land. I don't feel like it's saying anything near as deep as Roma is. And maybe that's not a good criteria to pick, but Roma is certainly aiming for something, I think, a lot deeper.
You're talking about more of a societal story than there is an actual personal story, right?
Well, sure. Because,
and I think you've said this before, and I think I understand, but their professions are what really chap your ass, right? Like, oh, she gets to be a famous movie star now, and oh, he gets to be a touring fucking, you know, band member.
I'm saying everybody at some point in their life wants to be a movie star. Usually they grow out of it or get a real job and move on, and that's what La La Land is tapping into. But on a surface level, it's a lot harder for me to connect to a rich and famous actress who is wistful about a romance she didn't get to continue than whatever happens in Roma, which I feel like is a lot more like life and death kind of shit, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
no,
yeah,
you're
he got
right.
His jazz club and she got to be a famous actress and, you know, it's cute, but that speaks
it's
that
cute.
Speaks more to Hollywood, which is why it was so nominated, than it does to regular people. So, you know, and again, I've talked enough about Roma. I don't think anyone's going to be surprised where I'm going to vote here whenever we do vote, because this is one of the few movies I've seen in the last few years that actually made me rethink some of my life and how I view certain circumstances. And I try to be a little less happy on my victories these days, and I try and be a little less depressed, or not depressed is the right word, but upset about my losses, and recognize that, you know, it's a pendulum, man. When I'm up, my neighbor's down. My neighbor's up, I'm down. And my life is no more important than yours, his. I don't know. It's just I get that the movie doesn't hit you that way. But it did me, man. And I long for movies like that now. That's why when you said, Chris, that movie on Mubi that you watched kind of reminded you about Roma a little bit, at least in the early going. It makes me want to watch it because I want
Whereas
to be challenged.
Whereas the one that I was watching did not do.
Well,
no, for sure. No, I'm actually not sure if I said it during the Mubi ad, but Workers does have a lot of things in common with Roma, I feel like. Yeah. I mean, it's not. It's definitely not exactly like it, but it has some things for sure. A lot of things are going to remind you of it. This is going to be the hardest one for me to pick, because I recently, like I said, I recently saw Roma. When I first watched Roma, I kind of liked it, but I wasn't on board with where everybody else was. I watched it 2 months ago and I was like, wow, this is way better than I remember it. And I think it was because, as I said, I think in the first time, the first bracket, I kept expecting something to happen and nothing ever really happened. And then going into that second viewing, knowing what happened, I was able to just sit back and enjoy it some more. But I also haven't seen La La Land in forever. So this is one of those things where it's going to be hard for me to come up with a pick, because I feel like if I picked Roma right now, it would be recency bias. And if I picked La La Land, I would be just kind of blindly picking it. So I'm going to have to kind of figure out where I want to go on this, because have you guys already picked essentially?
I think, pretty much.
Without
it
officializing.
I'm going to go with La La Land. I do want to ask, though, just in case it unfortunately leaves, do you guys know how they did that one shot of her getting the kids out of the water? Because that one shot is worth the entirety of the movie to me. It's so gorgeously done. It's so tense. It's as tense as anything you see in Gravity or Children of Men or anything like that, because she goes under the water several times.
Yeah.
And you're thinking there's no way that she's going to come out with every single one of them. Have you guys seen any of the making of or anything like that?
No, I really want to watch the Netflix just put one out a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
I really want to watch it. I haven't yet, but now that I'm basically self-quarantined, I'll get to it. I don't know how they shot that. But you know, he's the one-shot master, dude.
He is.
Like
he's like this movie,
even that
master.
Even that riot where the camera spins from the department store out to the riot and then back inside and all the way back to Children of Men, he's been doing this. So
even back in Great Expectations, there's a shot that starts in his opening, in Ethan Hawke's opening, where it follows him all the way through. There's like an opera singer that comes up to him and everything. Then he goes around, he meets a few art dealers, sees Estella, sees Gwyneth Paltrow, and it follows her leaving and him going right after her, all the way into the restaurant where Hank Azaria is in there, and then out of the restaurant where he's Mr. Steal Your Girl.
You're making me want to watch Prisoner of Azkaban again and see if there's anything in there that's like one shotty that I don't
remember. I'm trying to remember, actually.
I haven't seen that movie in years.
Yeah, I can't remember.
But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
That's homework.
Yeah.
We still watched it.
I think most of my picks have been, what would I watch again? If you had these two movies in front of me, which one would I pick more often? It's going to be La La Land.
No!
Well, if it makes you feel any better, if Roma had moved on, it was going up against Hell or High Water. So one of the others was going to go out.
All right, I'm back.
Jeremy is visibly upset over this.
Oh my God!
I tell you what, man, La La Land just from the very start declares itself, and I love it when a movie can make a huge statement of what it plans to be right at the beginning, and all those bright colors, those people getting out of their cars, the music, the dun 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 dun.
Who cares? Who cares? This is your Sideways, Chris. When Sideways beat LA Confidential in 2 years, you're going to regret this.
Maybe so, but then we would have had to decide between that and Hell or High Water the next time.
I know what I'm voting.
You already said that if Hell or High Water had been gone, then you know you would have been upset. So I'm curious as to what you would have picked between those two.
Well, if I had to pick between Hell or High Water and Roma, it would have been Roma in half a second. Like that movie. That movie is in me. It's in my bones. And,
I'm wondering if I have a movie that is that internal to me. I love The Godfather and all that stuff, but that movie connected with you on a level that I wasn't expecting.
No, more than any movie I can remember, man. And it's like, this is the best movie of the decade for me. You guys just took it out behind barn and shot it.
Like that's right.
That's the way I look at it.
Put it down.
I look at it as fuck Roma more than
that's right.
Than anything.
That's what I heard.
Yeah,
that's
exactly. I guess the consolation is we didn't pick Under the Skin over Roma, right?
Oh Jesus. That would have hurt.
But that's a tough one for me, man. And it's, again, I believe that Roma's probably the better, I don't know, maybe it feels like it's the better technical film, but like La La Land's got a lot of great technical work to it as well.
It does.
I just feel like it's the one that I'm going to pick more often. And that's what I had to end up. You're right. Maybe in 2 years I will be like, man, La La Land really hasn't held up. Have you seen that shit lately? But right now, I wish I had watched La La Land, again and to really make a better competition of this and everything. But it's just my gut on that as where I'm at now. So
I only hope I can hurt you later in this bracket as much as you have hurt me.
Let's move on to the number one seed Mad Max Fury Road going up against the 8 seed Blind Spotting. I recently saw Mad Max Fury Road, the black and chrome edition.
Oh, what'd you think of that?
I didn't like it as much as the color edition, but I think it may be because I'm so used to the color edition that the, you know, it's one of those, it feels like, you know, it's kind of like when you hear that band do a cover of a song first before you hear the original, and the cover, you're like, oh, the cover's so much better. Like, yeah, you know, yeah, like Guns N' Roses, Live or Let Die. That's way better than that Wings version. Fuck that. and so like, I watched this one and I was like, it's very interesting when you watch it. It you know, the tone of all the scenes are so much different from what you remember and everything. I think I just like that color a little bit more. But who knows? Maybe
did he release that? Did George Miller actually put that out?
Yes. You can buy that on a Blu-ray, like, yeah, the black and chrome.
So he, I mean, my question was, he had, was this his idea, I guess?
Yeah, there's actually a director's introduction before the black and chrome starts.
That's so interesting because it seems like all the colors and all the vividness seems so very, very deliberate,
mm-hmm,
that taking that away is just, I mean, maybe it's just looking to tool around or whatever, but it seems like just the detail on the fucking flame guitar dude,
yeah,
alone is worth seeing that, yeah, that movie in color.
That's the way I feel about it.
My favorite version of that movie is the one that's black and yellow, black and yellow, black and yellow.
Yeah, you know what it is. I believe that was Wiz Khalifa before Wiz Khalifa was famous. Or was, sure, that Waka Flocka Flame?
They're the exact same person to me. I think Mad Max Fury Road is the continuity king in my in my view, because it's there's so much going on. I remember, again, probably beat this dead horse enough, but Chris and I saw this at what used to be called the Grauman's Chinese Theater in L.A. I remember looking for continuity mistakes because there'd be so many freaking motorcycle riders coming up on the side cliffs and whatnot, and every time the camera turns around, they're all where they should be, man. It's like really hard to find continuity errors in this.
Yeah, and you know, while it's amusing to see that guitar guy every once in a while, and you know, it's just funny that this, you know, he's brought this guy to play music and stuff.
He's fucking jamming.
He even uses whatever riff he's playing as sort of a, like a horns approaching type of sound in the movie. Yeah. So like, even it doesn't matter where, like if the camera's going like over their bit, you know, the big entourage of people chasing after Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy, you hear that guitar playing when it goes over that. When they're in the distance, you can start faintly hearing the guitar in the background. You know, it's that kind of movie where everything was, it kind of reminds me of, this is another off topic thing, but it kind of reminds me of The Simpsons, where there was a producer who said every time the nuclear power plant is shown, we have to hear a crow caw. We have to hear a crow caw every time the nuclear plant is shown. And so like there would be episodes where they'd forgotten about it, and this guy would watch it and he'd be like, where's the crow caw? We need to put the crow caw there.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, that's the type of thing. And this movie's so simple. So like it's hard to believe that we push this movie up so much because it's a drive forward and a drive back. And
it's like a wind sprint, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you remember wind sprints?
Yeah.
Just go down there and then come back.
Right. Exactly. You know, it's, they're going towards this, place where supposedly there's all this stuff growing and everything like that. And of course the stunning moment of this movie is they go across this area that's just completely dead and have Skeksis living on it and stuff. and they go past it, and then they end up where all the women are, station these older women, and they're like, yeah, we used to have a place like that, but everything's died now, there's nothing there anymore. And it's like, we just went over that place. They didn't, like, the place that was supposed to be so lush and beautiful, they went over it like it was a second thought. They didn't even know it was they didn't even know it was the place. And and you know, then they found out, hey, it's gone now. But yeah, movie has a lot of great themes to it. It's well shot. The action's awesome. And then it goes up against Blindspotting.
What becomes of the war boys? Do they, at the end of the movie, do they basically pledge fealty to Furiosa? Or are they killed off?
No, I think that's what the movie is implying, that they pledge fealty, because the whatever Joe guy is, he's dead. So whoever's killed that guy is now the king in their eyes. I think that's how they're sort of terming it, because, you know, if you follow these people all the way through it, this is their god, and I believe that they have a very simple outlook on life. If that person dies, then whoever killed that guy is their king now, or their queen, or whatever.
Oh wow.
But this movie's really good. Blindspotting. I haven't seen Blindspotting since when Jeremy talked about it so much that was 6 or 7 months ago. So I haven't seen it since then. So I've actually seen Mad Max Fury Road more recently. But have you gotten any more revelations out of Blindspotting in the past couple of months, Jeremy?
Oh, I feel like every time I watch it, I see something new. And I think the reason Blindspotting has made it this far in the bracket is that it's just very inventive. It's very unique. I've never seen a movie like this where certain parts of certain scenes are wrapped, because it's part of how these guys communicate with each other. And then in that final scene where he just erupts with this Hamilton-esque diatribe, I've never seen anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first time I watched it, I was up in the air like I was at the end of 8 Mile, just because of the rapping. Then I go back and watch it again, and I start seeing all of the subtle nods to how, not even subtle sometimes, but about the gentrification and of Oakland specifically. This movie has a lot to say about race and race relations and gentrification specifically. It's a rap movie about gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
And yet somehow it's thrilling. I see something new every time. I don't know how I'm going to vote. This is not like Roma versus La La Land, where I just knew immediately, because, you know, Mad Max Fury Road is also very inventive. I've also never seen a movie quite like that. And, you know, technically, he was working on those storyboards for 10 plus years. Like, this is a feat. Like, we don't really give him enough credit for this accomplishment. So it's hard to know. But I do wish more people would watch Blindspotting. You know, Fury Road was a blockbuster, and Blindspotting is kind of indie. And what life it has is going to be word of mouth like this. So, even if it doesn't win this bracket, if you still haven't seen it, it's not super long, great performances, and there's a lot of meat on that bone.
Why does he do that at the end? Is it, from what I understand, he explains it in the rap as saying, this is the only way I can communicate to you.
Yes.
Is it more for that character, or is it more for the police officers let him understand what he's saying, and that's the only way that he can get that across?
I think it's both, honestly. I think it's the most natural way for that character to communicate. I think if he had simply spoken to the officer and said, you don't know what it's like, I don't think the officer would have had any kind of revelation. I think it's very clear by the end of that scene that the officer has had his eyes opened.
He's trying to get his anger out, but in a way that, first of all, is not going to get him killed, because isn't it his last day of probation, or his last day of whatever, or arrested or whatever. But he's also pointing a gun at him, isn't he?
He is. He's pointing a gun at a police officer in the police officer's home. He could very easily be arrested for this, and I think the fact that he does get his message across to that guy is why he's not. And he even, I don't think there's ever any question that he's going to not shoot him. Because even part of what he says to that guy is, you know, the difference between you and me is I'm not a killer. You know, maybe that's how, like, I'm the guy to speak to this. Maybe this is how this kind of change we need in terms of race relations, particularly with the people of authority, you know, one person at a time. Maybe he changed that guy's mind and heart, and that guy can go on to do it for someone else. But the movie is a lot deeper than just fancy rapping. It's just disguised under that fancy rapping.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and pull off the Band-Aid. I'm picking Mad Max Fury Road here.
Band-Aid hurt.
Going to pick Blindspotting. Blindspotting is one of the – Blindspotting is one of the only movies that I thought was overhyped because Jeremy loved it so much. And then Chris – and not by any fault of you guys, but then Chris saw it and he really loved it too. And I was like, well, all right, fine. I'll just watch it. And it exceeded my expectations, even that. And that kind of movie is just right up my alley. So, I love Fury Road too. But like you said, it's a very simplistic story, even though it's expertly done. So, I'm going to go Blindspotting.
Oh, Jesus. Hang on, I need a minute.
Weren't expecting that one, were you?
I really wasn't. Okay. Despite everything I just said, I'm going to go Mad Max Fury Road.
Mm-hmm.
I want Blindspotting to go on just so more people will hear us talk about it and watch it. But if I put these two together, Blindspotting is an accomplishment of creative writing and good performances. And Mad Max Fury Road is an accomplishment on such a much bigger scale that I really don't think, like, people look at the Fast and Furious movies and they cost, you know, $300 million and they ran cars out of a building and jumped into another building. But that's not what Mad Max Fury Road was. And Mad Max Fury Road is mostly practical. I do not underestimate that continuity stuff because it's not paid enough attention to. So that's my vote, and I'm really sorry to David Diggs.
Sure, and a lot of these matchups by, you know, necessity are going to be unfair because, you know, when you talk about the money that goes into a movie like Mad Max Fury Road as compared to a Blindspotting, and even so, even if you threw $100 more million at Blindspotting, it's not like it's going to become, you know, suddenly this way bigger scale movie or anything. It's face spacing.
Spring is in the air at Littleton Coin Company, and we want to help you brighten your collection. Visit us at littletoncoin.com all month long to enjoy 15% off your purchase. With a wide selection of coins, paper money, supplies, and more, Littleton Coin Company has something for every collector's taste. Use promo code SPRING at littletoncoin.com for 15% off your purchase all month long. Restrictions apply. Littleton Coin Company, serving collectors since 1945.
But, Mad Max Fury Road moves on. It will go up against the winner of the matchup between Nightcrawler, the 5 seed, and The Nice Guys, the 4 seed. I watched Nightcrawler in the past 24 hours.
Wow, you have watched a lot of movies.
But a lot of times before these brackets, I have an insane marathon of things going on. Like, I saw 5 movies in the last 24 hours. I saw 3 for the bracket. I saw 2 on Mubi. So, it's one of those things. I needed to see Nightcrawler again. I had not seen it in a long time. Just to refresh my memory on this movie, but Jake Gyllenhaal is he's just like this snowball of force as he goes through. Like, at first he can't even get a job. He's interviewing for jobs. He can't even get one. And then he just happens to stumble on this, you know, this news story thing happening on the street where Bill Paxton and his crew are shooting this, this guerrilla footage of, you know, a car crash. And he starts getting really interested in doing this thing for himself. He actually asked Bill Paxton for a job, and Bill Paxton's like, you know, get the hell out of here. Gyllenhaal is just super, super like driven during this thing. He starts researching everything he can on how to find these stories for footage to sell to news stations. And he you don't realize how much research he's done until the movie starts getting really dark. You realize he's driven, but you don't realize like probably every time we're not seeing him, he is sitting there looking for ways to get advantages in the job that he's in. And by the end of it, you know, he's like the main guy. He is the guy that people are going to look forward to getting his footage from and everything, because he gets the most insane stuff. I watched a little making of on this too. It was based on a real guy, I guess, from like,
wow.
I guess it was from the 30s though. I think I heard 30s. So like, So not a lot of the stuff that, you know, maybe I misheard that, but,
he's Jude Law's character from Road to Perdition.
He's Jude Law's character. He has a bunch of staples in his face or a bunch of, glass in his face. But yeah, so it's crazy because he like, Jake Gyllenhaal is going well above. Like at first you're like, this is fucked up what he's doing. But then he goes over that line. It seems like he's towing the line and then he goes over it. And he's just got this sort of like, I don't know, this logic to it, that you, he just has a way of making it seem good for himself. I don't know. It's insane. Like he gets to that home invasion thing before the cops do, and he even catches the guys on camera, and then he goes into the house and like all up in everybody's business who are just shot to death, and then he cuts out that part where he had the faces and everything and sells that part, you know, to the news station, you know, just so that he can get another lead to another story later on.
Yeah, I think the... what stands out to me, I've seen this movie three times, I think the heart of the movie is supposed to be that when he gets to the home invasion before the cops and films them, lets them leave, and then goes in to get his footage. That's supposed to be the moment where you go, wow, he's gone too far.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually after that for me when he goes up to the fridge and he subtly moves the picture so that it makes a better composition in his shot because the picture's closer to the bullet hole. That's the moment where I'm like, motherfucker is the devil.
Right. Yeah. And then, I mean, everything is incremental, right? Like every time, like he does that. And then the next thing is that he moves a body in a car crash. and so that shot will be better. And I think he understands like a lot of the things that he's doing. I don't think he realizes that there's anything wrong with what he's doing. Does he know right and wrong here? I don't know if he does.
No,
absolutely. He's not looking to be redeemed. He's looking to be successful and to be admired. And he's such a loathsome character. I'm glad you said he was the devil. He's like, I hate this character.
Well, he blackmails her for sex. Really well.
Yeah.
Oh, like, God. He's terrible. And it's all for self-gain. And I don't know what Barrett, the clinical term is. I think there is a clinical mental health term for people who don't know the difference between right and wrong.
Oh, it's psychopathy. I mean, it literally is being a psychopath.
Yeah.
And where you just want what is best for you personally.
Yeah.
If he wants sex, he's going to get sex by any means necessary. If he wants money, if he wants that car, then this is how he's going to do it. And I wonder why we root for this guy at all, or why we're interested in this story at all. I guess maybe we want him to get caught, but he never does get caught, right?
Mm-mm.
I don't know if you watch this movie hoping he'll get caught. I think you just watch it as sort of as an I don't know, as a with dark interest, maybe. I don't know what it is, but you're not really, I don't know if I was sitting there going, oh boy, I hope he's caught for what he's doing here. Don't know if that really entered my mind, and maybe that makes me the sick fuck. But
well, it was actually reversed on Breaking Bad. You were saying that you wanted him to Walter White to get caught by the end.
I think there,
and I was like, no, go.
I think there might be an issue there where I'm like, I think I may want him to get caught by the end of the movie, but not like during it. So like after he does the last stuff where he gets Riz Ahmed dead and everything, he basically kills Riz Ahmed in this. I sort of wish he's captured there, but the movie's about to end at that point. Right. So, you know, if this had gone on for another quote unquote episode, then I definitely want him to get caught.
Well, and I don't think the movie wants him to get caught, because I think the movie wants, I think the movie wants us to realize it's our fault. Like, if there wasn't viewer demand for this kind of, you know, closer and closer to the edge news and news footage and sensationalist work in journalism. So I think the movie is pointing its finger at us. And if he gets arrested at the end, that lets us off the hook.
Yeah.
And so it works better with him getting away with it, even though, you know, he's the devil.
Yeah, isn't that the subtext of this movie? Even though it looks like the news station is an evil organization, because they, because she, Rene Russo, you know, puts it out there right at the beginning. He's like, she's like, crime done by black or brown people in affluent neighborhoods, that's what we go after first. And so it sounds like, wow, this news station is awful, but that's exactly what the people are watching when they're watching the news and everything. And it may not be, it may not be news. They're framing the news however they want to in this thing. Like they call some of these, like, they're trying to come up with a narrative for these things, even though there may not be a narrative. And it's just, you know, it's dangerous, but like, that's exactly what we're going for, right? We go for that shit. The scene with him and Rene Russo at dinner is it's where it starts really getting crazy. I mean, I guess it's crazy, like, as soon as he crosses the line for the first time. But for me, he's trying to get in good with her so that she just constantly just pays him money. And he's going to go out there and get that footage. She, at first he's like, let's do this. And then she's resistant to it. And then he goes, well, I've been reading about you, and you have only been at certain stations for 2 years, and you're about to get to your second year now. So what's up? He knows things about her that put her in a bad position, because if she's about to get canned after 2 years, she needs something that's really going, I mean, and she's probably tired of getting canned after 2 years. So he knows that immediately. And then even after that, she's sort of resistant. And then she, you know, then he goes, you know, he piles even more information on there where, like, you know, you're fucked. You're going to have to go with what I'm giving you, or else you're not going to be here anymore. She could take a moral stance and say, no, I'll just get fired and deal with it. But no, she doesn't. She's that driven that she wants this guy's stuff, even though she knows in the back of her head, this guy is doing some real shady shit to get this footage. I love the scene too with her and the guy that's like a producer or something like that early on. And when he gets that, he shows that footage of the refrigerator, and he's like, how did you get in there? Did they let you in? And he doesn't answer the question. He goes, well, I called out, nobody answered, and the door was open. So I went in, and then the guy's like, man, this is fucked up. We can't use this. This is across the line. And Rene Russo tells him, oh, come on. Your job is to create the tweet of the day and to tell Deb to turn sideways when she's doing the weather. And so it's, you know, she's obviously awful too, but he's done so much research on her that he's got her right where he wants her and everything. And it's a scary thing. Like, as he keeps piling stuff on that you think, okay, well, that's where it's going to end, right there. And then he just keeps piling more stuff. So it goes up against the Nice Guys. I haven't seen the Nice Guys as recently, but man, this movie is so watchable, man.
I have seen the Nice Guys very recently, and not for the bracket, but because every time I see it on HBO, I stop and watch it. This may be, now we're talking about Shane Black, who I think played a role in creating the modern action comedy with Lethal Weapon. He's written a lot of great films. But I think this is one of, if not the best action comedy of since the year 2000. I think it's better than Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. It's super rewatchable. Here's an actual mystery here, right? Like, yeah. I like watching Whole Nine Yards. It's a decent action comedy, mostly comedy, but there's no mystery there. That's not trying to be like a real adventure or detective story, but this one is. It's just in between some of the most hilarious shit I've ever seen. And I would watch, this goes against every fiber in my being, I would watch more movies with these two guys solving crimes together, because Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling playing off of each other, like, I never expected such great comedic time.
Cool. Yeah, especially coming from those two. I mean, they're not really known for... Now, Ryan Gosling has a background in some comedy. He was funny in Crazy Stupid Love and all that, but nothing approaching this level of almost slapstick at times, of smart comedy, of acting, the greatest drunk acting I think I've ever seen. Just throwing in random noises and words in there to be like, hold on, that's not right. An absurd, like, broad comedy. I mean, the guy, this may be, outside of La La Land and maybe including La La Land, my favorite Ryan Gosling performance.
Oh man. And it's his character, despite this being a comedy, their recent past is tragic, because he had a gas leak, but he has a bad nose and he thought his wife was making it up. And then the house caught fire and his wife died.
Oh,
like, that's the backstory of why the daughter keeps going to the old lot of the house and reading in the middle of the night. And when Russell Crowe comes to talk to her, she's like, you're standing on the toilet. and like, you know, he says, your dad tells me you're going to rebuild. And she's like, does it look rebuilt to you? There's like a real tragic reason for the rift between daughter and father, even though the bond is still clearly there. And I love that moment. Because early on, she says, you're the world's worst detective. That's about halfway through the movie. And then he figures out a clue, which ends up being wrong later. But he says to her, world's worst detective, huh? Oh, no, it's actually after he finds the film projector in the coffee table and it comes up and he's like, world's worst detective, huh? She gives this smile that is such, it's so pure. Like, I'm so proud of my dad right now, even though he's a fuck up. I could watch this movie every day and probably never get tired of it. It's just candy.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say about it.
I don't either. So why don't we go ahead and vote here? I'm going to pick the Nice Guys.
Mm. Oh, I am too, by a landslide. I really do like Nightcrawler, but there's no competition. And if I'm choosing between two,
I guess it depends really on, you know, our Nightcrawler obviously takes itself a little bit more seriously. It's like it's a movie that's trying to be a serious film here. And the Nice Guys is really just trying to be the entertainer.
Nobody wants to see your dick, kid. Oh, man, I love it.
And so the Nice Guys moves on. It goes up against Mad Max Fury Road the next time we come back to the North region.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's going to get harder. That's the way this goes.
Yep.
The next time we go to a bracket will be in the East region. That was, those were some tough ones again, and it's going to just get worse and worse. So
yeah, it is.
All right, everybody. It is time to talk about BetterHelp once again.
BetterHelp. I got
to
tell you something, you people, I am not handling this well. I am not handling this pandemic very well in terms of anxiety. I am not an anxious person. Historically, I haven't really had problems with anxiety. I've had some other problems, but a little bit of depression, situational things. But I've never been an anxious person. So this whole thing is scaring me. It's scaring me for me and for my family and stuff like that systemically. And so because I've never experienced it before, I don't really know how to deal with it. Right. Like, I don't even know what to call it or how to treat it or anything like that. I've told people to do it, but it's hard for me to internalize how to slow yourself down when you're getting really, really worked up and, you know, control your breathing and stuff like that. And so I made like an emergency call to my BetterHelp counselor and said, we all know what's going on. What's going on with me and how can I manage it? And that was an extremely helpful session. She actually sent me some literature right afterwards to deal with worry and anxiety with global uncertainty. And it's been very, very helpful. And it's all through BetterHelp.
You know, one of the things that I do when I have a number of different tactics to try and help me come down from what might be an anxiety attack. One of them is to recite lyrics. Typically for me, it's like Eminem. Huh. And I'll even like try and learn new songs and then memorize the lyrics. And then when I hit anxiety, I go back to one of his songs and I just start doing the lyrics and it like shuts out everything else because my brain is focused on just remembering these lyrics. Does that make any sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I'm going to rip that off.
Yeah. And well, I actually had a therapist once, I might've mentioned this before, recommend that I take up chainsawing. And I said, holy crap, I would cut my arm off. And he was like, you know, it's so dangerous that it causes you to focus so much that you shut out all the anxiety.
I guess so. I don't think you should be handing out this advice, though.
No, I'm not saying you do that. I'm just talking about how you can trick your mind, even in a moment of anxiety. And I'm so thankful that BetterHelp exists and has this infrastructure in place before this pandemic hits, because now people who have maybe never experienced this kind of anxiety have a resource without having to leave their house.
Yeah. And it's terrific, man. I've logged onto it every day, really, this week while this has been going on. I'm logged into it right now. It's my session room. It's my counseling room. I see a picture of my lovely therapist, and I see the schedule. I see when she's available, any history of text between us, like everything is right there and it couldn't be easier. I love it. I recommend anyone, even if you're not diagnosed, especially in these times, think about it. If you want to give it a shot, go to betterhelp.com/sincast and you can get 10% off your first month, which is substantial, especially as many times as I'm planning on using it. BetterHelp.com/Zencast. Could not recommend it more.
Do we want to do some questions?
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
This is a super, super fun one. If you can make a movie by taking three characters from the middle of their respective films and throwing them into the events of a fourth film, what would this movie be? Example that this person offered is Ash Williams from Evil Dead 2, Max Rokatansky from Mad Max Fury Road. I guess I could probably pronounce that better. And Alex DeLarge from A Clockwork Orange. Then he wants to deliver a truckload of dynamite in Sorcerer. What a fuck.
That would be an incredible, like, what the fuck movie. All right, so I decided to go all time travel with this. I have Bill and Ted and Marty McFly in a Terminator movie.
I'm trying to wrap my head around that. That's hilarious.
Oh my god!
And I didn't know if people would consider Bill and Ted as one character. And, you know, because maybe I could have come up with a third movie to come up with and then, you know, and then put them in the Terminator. But if it's going to be that, I don't know who else I would put in after that. If you considered Bill and Ted one character in this question.
I actually thought about this a lot longer than I should have and ended up coming up with a really stupid answer. I'm going to take Brad Pitt from 12 Monkeys, yeah. Brad Pitt from Fight Club, and Brad Pitt from Meet Joe Black. I'm going to put all three, I'm going to put all three of them into a remake of Trapped in Paradise.
Yeah.
Because in Trapped in Paradise, you have like three brothers, quote unquote brothers. I don't think they're all brothers, but Nicolas Cage is like the only really smart one. And then the other two are varying degrees of stupid. And I feel like Brad Pitt from Fight Club is crazy. That's close to stupid. Brad Pitt from 12 Monkeys is, well, he's insane. And, you know,
no, I'm not.
I just think it would be really interesting to watch them along with the robotic Meet Joe Black performance who can't commit to anything, stuck in some town after they've robbed a bank. I think it'd be fun.
Meet Joe Black. My God. Is that the one where he's deaf?
Yes.
Yep. See, it's funny. Recently, people who weren't alive back when Meet Joe Black came out recently found the opening scene where Brad Pitt, who's, you know, who when he's playing his human self, gets hit by the car and realize how hilarious that scene is. It's supposed to be some, like, you know, horrible thing that happens, but it's so comical. What happens when he gets run over?
Oh, because he gets run over and then like hit again, and then like rolls over another time or something.
It's just the way he flies in the air. It's absolutely unreal.
And it takes forever to lead up to that.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, because there's like, it's a
cute or something.
Yeah, because he looks back at Claire Forlani. Claire Forlani looks back at him. Then he walks a little bit more. He looks back at her. She looks back at him. And then it's like it takes for like a minute and a half. And then finally he gets hit.
I love that. And plus, that's the only watchable part of that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like 6 hours long.
I don't know. I kind of liked it back in the day.
Did you really?
Yeah, it wasn't I didn't think it was bad. I mean, yeah, that getting hit by the car was bad, but like, you know, it is a long movie. It is long, way too long than it should be. And it's based on what was that? It was there was an original that came out that I think Gary Cooper was in or somebody. I can't remember who it was.
Oh, really?
But wow. Death Takes a Holiday, I believe, is what
there
the movie was called.
I thought it was going to be Death Knocks on Your Front Door.
Yeah, that was the sequel. That was the sequel. Man, they put Abbott and Costello in that one.
For my, did you do yours already?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, you did Bill and Ted. Okay, for mine, I'm going to take Lupita Nyong'o's character, Nakia, from Black Panther, Furiosa from Fury Road, and Tessa Thompson's character, Valkyrie from Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah,
and nice. I'm going to throw them into The Force Awakens, and I want them to do like a really complicated side plot involving like hustling and like stuff like that on Jakku.
Yeah.
All right.
I would watch that. I would watch the shit out of that.
Definitely.
this is interesting because the song has been released, but the movie has now been delayed, as has every movie in existence. But No Time to Die, the song, was released by Billie Eilish. So now that is released, who's an artist that you would like to see perform the next Bond theme, however, whatever iteration that is? This person would like to see Hozier, what they would do for a Bond film. This is very interesting to me.
Is it Hozier or Hozier?
I have no idea.
Doesn't really matter.
Just take him to church.
Yeah,
take
yeah.
Take him to church, James Bond, like a flower, everybody. Okay.
I settled on Daft Punk for this one.
Nice.
But I was also thinking... you know, it'd be cool to hear a Kendrick Lamar Bond theme.
Oh,
yeah, it would.
I almost thought of that.
Would. Because I think that he would come up with the orchestrations and everything around his own style that would be very Bond, but also very him as well, and it would be great.
That's a great call. Both of those are great calls. I actually really don't like Bond music very much. The only ones that I really like are the ones for a really shitty movie, but the World Is Not Enough, the garbage one. I thought that was really good. The classic, you know, Goldfinger is beautiful. Live and Let Die, second mentioned today.
Yep.
That's all right. And then the one by Chris Cornell for the Casino Royale is maybe my favorite right now.
Yeah. What about those early Shirley Bassey ones?
It does nothing for me. Doesn't get it up for me at all. No.
Hmm.
Not in general, just Goldfinger and stuff like that, just because it's so classic.
Yeah.
But I actually would love to see, there's this flamenco duo, Rodrigo y Gabriela, and they do flamenco almost like metal. Like it's almost spy music when you listen to it anyway. It's like very well paced and it's fantastic and it's crazy intricate. They're both insanely talented, very percussive. They do I've got their album right here. They do a cover of Stairway to Heaven and it's all instrumental. It's no singing at all. Stairway to Heaven has one of the most iconic guitar solos of all time. And it's not an easy guitar solo to play. It's, you know, there's a lot of fretwork and stuff like that. This guy plays maybe like 900 extra notes in that solo while still playing that solo. It's amazing the stuff that this guy pulls out. So I think they'd be awesome in a Bond thing.
Mm-hmm. I have a very Jeremy answer and my real answer.
All right.
And the very Jeremy answer is Rage Against the Machine, baby.
Boom!
Because I would love nothing more than to have Bond like that down the barrel of the gun thing where he points and it's just da-da, and then all of a sudden, quit it now! but my real answer is an artist I've heard only on Channel 36 on satellite radio, which is not advanced placement. It's what's it called?
Is it XMU? Oh, it's Alt Nation.
It's Alt Nation.
Oh, okay.
Alt Nation. Yeah.
The artist is 2 Feet. And the song you've probably heard is I Feel Like I'm Drowning. Mm-hmm. Feel Like I'm Drowning. He does a lot of guitar work and big heavy bass. And I just think it's mood music that would be perfect for a Bond film. He's had 2 or 3 songs, I think it's a he, on Alt Nation. I've loved every one of them. And I just thought that, like, style-wise, that would be a really cool Bond thing.
Yeah, I'm thinking of that song right now, and I think they would be perfect Bond material for sure.
Especially if the Bond movie was called, you know, Feel Like I'm Drowning. Yeah. That song.
Yeah. But yes, if they enlisted that guy to make a Bond song, I think he would do a good one for sure.
Yeah, I thought so.
What are your favorite performances in which the actor has been cast against type? This example would be Michael Cera in This Is the End, which is a hilarious performance.
Mm-hmm.
That thing where he's sucking on a lollipop as a girl is like eating out his butthole, Jay Baruchel comes in and he's like, you can go. It's fine.
I think Michael Cera was cast against type even in Molly's Game. I'm so used to him being, you know, that geeky, lovable, schlubby, nerdy guy. And in that movie, he's like a fast talking asshole.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's a good choice. That's not a choice. You didn't make a choice. We haven't answered it yet.
I think a lot of times people forget how against type it was for Woody Harrelson to be in Natural Born Killers.
Oh, yeah.
We knew Woody Harrelson from Cheers at the time, and he was this, you know, he was the dumb character in Cheers. And then his movie career at that point, he had been like everyman kind of guys, like in Indecent Proposal and White Men Can't Jump and stuff like that. So when I saw the trailer for Natural Born Killers and I saw they had shaved his head bald and, you know, you ain't seen nothing yet and all that, I was like, Jesus Christ, this is Woody Harrelson completely different from anything we've ever seen before. Compare that performance to fucking Woody in Cheers. It's the polar opposite.
That's a good call.
That's true.
I had 2 written down that I like. Steve Carell in Foxcatcher.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Because even when he's done dramatic, quote unquote, dramatic stuff like The Big Short or what have you, there's still this comic element. And in Foxcatcher, there's none of that. None of that at all. And so we're so used to Michael Scott and the humor from The Office. And so that one stood out to me. And then Jennifer Aniston in the Horrible Bosses movies.
Yeah.
And now she's continued to do this in a few more movies. But up until that movie, she was known as a nice girl. She's just nasty in those movies. Like, nasty, nasty.
Yeah.
And she plays it really well. But the first time, now, of course, I saw him out of order. So I saw Horrible Bosses 2 first. But when I watched that movie, I was like, wow, this is really like nothing I've ever seen her do before. So
I think she's definitely dirtier. At least they give her more specific dialogue that's dirtier in the second one than they do in the first one. So
he says, hey, it's my first time on the slopes. I'm going to stay off the Black Diamond.
She is so smoking hot in those movies, though.
She is.
Yep.
I mean, when she's dirtied up like that, that's my kind of Jennifer. Anyway. One of the common responses to this would be Robin Williams and insomnia, but I think Robin Williams had been playing, you know, certainly dramatic roles. He's typically been the good guy, but he had been playing dramatic roles before. But he certainly wasn't ever a killer before. I don't think so.
Not really. He had always played like some like moral character or some, you know, like Fisher King and Good Will Hunting and What Dreams May Come and all these movies like that. He was never like the bad guy.
What Dreams May Come keeps coming on the cable channels, and I keep thinking maybe I should watch this again because I always liked the visual of it. I always liked the aesthetic of it, but haven't gone with it yet.
I haven't seen
it. I remember it being bad.
I haven't seen it since it came out, and but I think I looked at the IMDb the other day, and I noticed that it had like a 7.1.
Wow.
So it has definitely gotten a following over the years.
Interesting. Wow.
I remember it being boring.
I didn't either. Yeah, me too. I remember seeing the trailers and I was like, man, this looks awesome. And then I watched it and I hated it.
I got a couple more. I would say Meryl Streep for Devil Wears Prada because she's not typically a villain.
Yeah.
And even though the character doesn't turn out to be all that villainous, she's usually not that way.
Yeah.
But what that made me think about is The River Wild and being Kevin Bacon play against type because he's usually the good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, I really like The River Wild.
Yeah.
Isn't John C. Reilly in that too?
He is.
He's the other guy. I think he's Kevin Bacon's guy.
It's crazy how many movies John C. Reilly was in before you realize John C. Reilly was a thing.
It is.
Like I think I first really became aware of John C. Reilly back in Boogie Nights era. And then, you know, recently, like every once in a while, I'll see some movies like Casualties of War or something like that. He's in that, and it was like, you know, it's like baby John C. Reilly in these movies from the 80s. It's crazy to see him.
He's got how many credits do you think he has, Chris?
John C. Reilly, I'm going to say probably. Let's see. I don't think he's the kind of actor that's been in everything to the point of that he has over 100, but I'm going to say like 95.
You're right around it. It's 105, but then there's a lot of like Tim and Eric Awesome Show, like that.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Which is he's like a huge meme generator guy from that because he did that Professor Steve Brill.
Yeah. The Perfect Storm was one that I forgot that he was in.
Yep.
Yep.
Never Been Kissed. Oh, yeah, the Thin Red Line.
Right.
He's the catcher in For the Love of the Game.
Yep.
River Wild. What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
Yeah.
Hoffa. Hoffa was another thing I saw recently. Days of Thunder.
Hoffa was another one because I had seen Hoffa around the time The Irishman came out. And I was like, holy shit, fucking John C. Reilly's in this too.
All right, one more here.
All right.
What is a TV show or film that you've seen or heard enough of to know that it's likely good, but you will not see, and why? For this person, it's The Handmaid's Tale. I've always hated seeing depictions of sexual and sexualized violence, even though I'm sure the show deserves its praise. I can't watch it. I'll stop it there because that is my pick. I'm never going to watch The Handmaid's Tale. There's enough misery in the world. It's why I stopped watching Walking Dead. I have no interest whatsoever in seeing Handmaid's Tale.
That's a good one.
There is a second part to this question, though, right? There is indeed. You're getting to that. Oh, okay.
As a follow-up, what's a show or film that pissed you off by blindsiding you with something you didn't like seeing, thus ruining any enjoyment you may have had watching it to that point? For this person, it's an unusual answer. It's 40 days and 40 nights. I saw it on a whim and had no idea what was coming. And the fact that it was treated as a joke because the victim was a guy and the perpetrator was a woman made it that much worse. Fuck that movie.
Josh Hartnett had no idea what was coming during the wet dream sequence either.
I've forgotten everything about that movie. I assume this is a sexual assault that they're talking about, but I've forgotten everything about that.
He plans to not have sex in any form 40 days and 40 nights, and this becomes known. So there are women who are trying to get him to break that 40 days and 40 nights thing. And they figure it's been so long, he'll go for any kind of sexual advances and stuff. So I believe there is a scene where a woman like tries to get him to break it forcibly. So,
wow. You know what's crazy? I mistook this movie. I thought they were talking about 40 Days of Night.
Oh, the vampire wow. Movie. The 30 Days of Night.
30 Days of Night.
Mm-hmm. 6 days and seven nights.
Yeah, 6 days, seven nights.
Anyway, what do you guys think?
Okay, so the first part of the question is, what will I not watch? And Human Centipede is up there as far as something I probably won't watch. However, given the right circumstances, I could still conceivably end up watching that movie. But I am never, ever going to just be like, you know what? I want to see what that movie's all about. Because I'm not going to do it. I think I saw the South Park episode making fun of that, and it's probably pretty close to what goes on in that movie, and so I don't really need to see the movie itself. As far as the one that blindsided me, Rick and Morty actually has an episode where it's Morty's turn to come up with an adventure. So they do this every once in a while in the series. This is a first season episode, and Morty picks the adventure, and they go to this place where they have to climb a beanstalk, and they have there's giants up at the top, and one of the giants notices them. And he dies. They go to a trial over it because they think that these tiny people are the ones responsible for killing this giant and everything. All this, but the trial ends successfully for them though, because somebody from the ACLU comes in and says, I'm fighting for tiny people's rights everywhere and everything like that. And so they get off. So now they have to go down this giant staircase, to get back home. And it's taking them forever, and as they get down to this one step, there's a bar located in the step, in one of the steps. So they go in this bar, and they're trying to figure out how they can get down faster, or they're just at least taking a break while they're going down these steps. Morty walks into a bathroom, and there is a character in there that tries to rape him, like straight up tries to rape him. And I think they were trying to be either darkly comic with it, or they were just, I think I heard later that there was they wanted to put something in that was really like this is the type of thing that happens. They have never gone back to this, by the way, and thank God they haven't, because it completely takes you out of the whimsy of that episode. Completely takes you out, and this rapist gets his comeuppance by the end of it. But still, there, while you're sitting there like, oh man, this is a fun episode, this is really fun, that happens, and it's just like, they didn't need that at all.
Yeah, you know what really sucks is when you're watching like a this is hard, terrible to even say, but you're watching like an otherwise quote, normal movie or comedy from the 80s. And then all of a sudden N-word pops up.
Yep.
And just, you know, among white people.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like, this used to go on like on cinema.
It was perfectly acceptable because, you know, these people were talking like people talk.
Yeah. And then you have that whole Tarantino diatribe in Pulp Fiction where it's like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, you look at those in today's eyes and you're like, what? What are you thinking? Why was he not penalized more for that retroactively? But it's just so off-putting now.
There weren't enough.
It's hard to watch.
The problem is there wasn't enough voices that we could all go to and see how offensive that was. Because at the time, even I'm telling you right now, I would justify that type of thing in my head. Because that's a movie and characters talk like that. And sure, you know, but it's too casual. It's like, when you look at it, you look back at it now, it's like, yeah, it's too casual. You went over a line there and you were doing it all in the name of like, well, people talk that way, but it wasn't your barrier to break or whatever. It wasn't your, I don't know. It was totally justified back then. Nobody thought about it. Nobody even gave it a thought. And that's why getting the extra voices that we have in the past few years has been important.
Mm-hmm.
Am I saying something that's shitty, by the way? Am I saying something?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Because I make it sound like I'm justifying what they said back then.
No. You're saying society essentially justified.
Yes. Right.
Okay. So I have seen, my wife has been watching Outlander. The Stars show, based on a very popular series of books. She basically ran through the four seasons that existed. And got caught up to, I guess they're halfway through season 5. So now she has to wait a week between episodes. It's driving her crazy. But I have walked in there and seen enough of this show to know that it's quality, but also to know that I will never watch it myself. Now, there are a few reasons. One, the show has a lot of whipping. Like, I tweeted about it, but the first season, it seemed like every time I walked in there, someone was getting whipped.
Like bad whipping or good whipping?
Like Jesus whipping. Like bad whipping.
Oh, okay.
Whipping.
I didn't mean to laugh. I thought you were saying like S&M
not like sexual
type of whipping.
It's like torture whipping. It's also
Jesus whipping. Sorry.
I'm gonna pigeonhole the show in a way I shouldn't. It has a lot of the elements that Game of Thrones had. Including good performances from actors you're not super familiar with, including lots of sex, including an old setting. This is set back in early Scotland. They speak a lot of Gaelic on this show. And I don't think I have another Game of Thrones in me. And even though I know the show is very different, and people who love Outlander are going to jump on me for calling it Game of Thrones. Like, I think it pushes a lot of the same buttons. And I'm not down with the whipping. But in terms of a movie that I was digging that something happened in that has caused me to never watch the movie again, it's American History X when he stomps that dude's jaw on the curb.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be honest, I had never even conceived of that kind of violence. Like, it had never even crossed my mind that someone would ever do that to another human being, and it all happened so fast. It was very, very shocking to me, and I have, you know, never gone back to that movie ever since. So there you go.
Yeah,
that's interesting. I've watched that movie several times, and every time that scene gets harder and harder to watch, and I can't even really talk about one particular aspect of it without making myself sick, but there's a sound that I, even thinking about that sound, it makes me cringe.
Yeah.
And so I've watched it around that area, which is not the point. The point is to see stuff like that, stark images, because his performance is so good. Ed Norton is, but yeah, you're right. I haven't gone back to that in years. because the thing that I remember is that sound.
Yep. Yep.
Well, just getting the guy to put his mouth on the curb is enough for me. Like that, I've seen that movie.
No, that's the sound that I'm talking about.
Oh, that's the sound? Oh, yes. Okay. I thought you were talking about the stomping sound.
No, where his teeth, because they do a good job. They put, yeah. They boost the sound of his teeth on the concrete.
I wondered after that how he even got out of jail that fast, because that's one of those where it's like, you're like, yeah, I'm assuming that guy died, right?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, something that unusual, you would think that he would have been in jail for 20 years. Doesn't matter how good he was, when he got there.
It may be like a subtle commentary on the preferential.
Could be,
too, you know,
could
I mean?
Be, could be. It feels like a movie like that would have made that point. But
yep.
But yeah, I know what you mean. Horrible to end the show on that note.
Oh, sorry.
We probably should have done that question first. That'll do it for this week. Hopefully we won't have to do this many more weeks, but you know what? We're going to do it as long as it takes. Mm-hmm. We're going to do it as long as it takes. We're not going to, until there's something out there that says, hey, vaccine, or hey, cure, or something like that.
Well, I cannot wait for that. Every time, I don't want to check the alerts on my phone, but every time I have to, because I want to see that one like piece of good news come by, you know.
But we will be doing it this way for the conceivable future. For now, so that'll do it for this week. Keep going to Sincast presented by CinemaSins on Facebook. We also have a CinemaSins Twitter, a music video Sins Twitter. We're on SoundCloud. We also have a Discord. If you want to get on Discord, you can go to our Reddit page and find the link on the right side, or you can go to the Facebook page and private message me, and I will give you a link there. But that'll do it for this week. It's Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Barrett Scher. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
It is interesting, just sitting in that studio for the last, 3-4 years now?
Yeah.
We built it in 2016.
Yep.
Jesus.
And we've recorded every Sincast there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of them.
Only I may dance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what episode that's from.
Is it the movie? Is it the South Park movie?
I think it's
with Conan O'Brien. Oh, okay.
It's the Simpsons, and it's something where somebody who works for that person or is an underling or something like that starts dancing, and they says, no, only I may dance, or something like that.
Oh, it's Conan. Okay, so you're right, but it's Conan O'Brien, and it's when Bart is on there for doing the, like, being famous for, I think it's the...
Oh, that's right. It's I didn't do it. Yeah.
It is Conan O'Brien.
Yeah, it is Conan O'Brien. That's weird. We got our South Park and Simpsons like nice and mixed up there.
I think we're as good to go as we're going to get.
Okay.
All right.
That's really reassuring.
My latest one is Superman. You know that Eminem song, Superman?
Uh-huh.
That's the one I'm trying to learn now.
I'm totally stealing that.
Ever since I broke up with What's a Face, I'm a different man. Kiss my ass. Uh-oh. Kiss my lip, bitch, my ass. Kiss my dick.
Because let's pick some motherfucking movie.
All right.
My son is in
here. Your son is in there?
He's not in here. He's in.